Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The Buddha said that the reason why he and you and I and all other beings have traveled and trudged endlessly through the rounds of birth and death, through the rounds of existence, is through not understanding four things. Not understanding the truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, discontent, dis-ease. Not understanding the cause of dukkha, not understanding the cessation of dukkha, and not understanding the way, the path of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. These four noble truths, these simple, straightforward qualities, through not understanding, not truly knowing these four principles that you and I and he, all beings, have had to travel and trudge around and around and around and around birth to death, birth, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, aging, death, birth to death, birth to death, over and over and over through all the different realms of being. And even not thinking about it in terms of lifetime to lifetime on a physical level, just the course of a day, you know, one individual day, traveling and trudging through all the different identities, you know, the enthusiast, the depressive, the great yogi, the failed slob, the kindly, generous bodhisattva, the eating demon, the mediocre, unremarkable, all these different births and deaths, being born into positive mind states, negative mind states, positive actions, neutral actions, negative actions. These two are what we get born into, how we create ourselves. So even though the Four Noble Truths are often presented as kindergarten Buddhism or basic Buddhism, chapter one, page one Buddhism, and can seem so simple, I find it's extremely helpful and important to look at that simple statement of the Buddha. It's through not understanding these four things that you and I, all beings, have continually reborn, continually following cycles of aversion, cycles of attraction, cycles of fear, cycles of identification, around and around and around, locked into the prison of becoming. And in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the Buddha's first discourse, he outlines this also in almost exact identical words, saying when I had not understood these four truths in their three aspects, then I did not claim full and complete enlightenment. But it was only when yato chako me bhikkhave imesu chatusu aryasa chesu, only when I had understood these four truths in their three aspects, then indeed I claimed full and complete enlightenment. So even though they seem so simple and so conceptually easy to understand, nothing demanding on the intellectual front, you know, when the Buddha uses the term fully understood, it doesn't mean comprehending the language. It doesn't mean being able to grasp the concept in terms of basic meaning, but it means this element of it really sinking into the bones, into the marrow, and then seeing not just the meaning of the truths and taking it in, but also intuiting the implications. Well, if this is true, then what does it say about what I fear, what I like, what I dislike, what I think I am, what I think others are? What does it say about that? And this is, in a way, what paramita is, the development of the spiritual virtues. Paramita is what enables the heart to recognize the implications of an insight or an understanding. If we have little paramita, then we see, everything is impermanent. Okay, yeah, right, yeah, everything changes, mental, physical, yeah, right, that makes sense. Okay, I'll buy that, no problem. If we have a lot of paramita, if that's been developed, if there's great spiritual virtue, then when we hear a phrase like, everything is impermanent, and it really goes into the bones, into the marrow, and the heart feels out the implications of that, it's like, oh, wow, well, that changes everything. What's the worth of this thing that I'm pursuing? What's the worth and what's the danger in the thing that I'm running away from? What's the reality of the thing that I'm opinionating about? How solid is the thing that I think that I am? What is that thing that seems to be the owner of my experience, my life? Oh. That insight resonates through all the realms of attitude and presumption, all the realms of perception and memory, ideation, every corner of our being. Oh, look at that. Wow. If that's true, then it changes the whole picture completely. So this is something to contemplate and consider. Also why so much of spiritual practice is about developing paramita, developing spiritual virtues, developing that ripeness of the heart, whereby those implications of a simple insight, a simple recognition that just like something, everything is impermanent, everything is uncertain, it's enabling, supporting the applying or the fruition of that kind of insight, catalyzing that insight to totally change the way that we see the world, we know the world. Just as in the story of the Buddha's life, when he's a prince in the palace, and then he first opens his mind to the presence of sickness and aging and death, then he says, and then the association that he makes is that, oh, well, if others are affected by these elements, then I must be too. And if this is where life is going, towards sickness, towards aging, towards death, then what is the point of attaching, identifying to that which is subject to aging, subject to sickness, subject to death? It's absurd, crazy. And then, as he says, and realizing that, then the vanity of youth left me, or the vanity of health left me, or the vanity of life left me. And most of us don't make that connection so immediately or so quickly. But the Buddha, who is so spiritually ripe, it was like, oh, well, if this seeing an old person recognizing the truth of aging, the truth of the vulnerability, fragility of the body and sickness, oh, well, if that's the case, what's the point of pursuing trying to take refuge in youth, because it's changing. It's not going. It can't be here forever. Sickness, you can't avoid sickness. Death is going to have its last breath one day. Has to. Can't be any other way. Oh, well, if that's the case, look at what that says about this, about my concerns, my preoccupations, my family, my body, my hopes and fears. Oh, changes everything. Well, even if we feel, well, I haven't got enough paramita, you know, part of a large part of our life here and what we're trying to do and what Lumpur Cha would always emphasize, rather than, say, trying to achieve enlightenment speaking in such grandiloquent terms, so much of the spiritual training that he imparted, and like we were having these readings from this bits of his biography the last few days, the austere and inspiring, awe-inspiring, and slightly, well, more than slightly humbling standard of practice, and the ferocity of attack on the kilesas that was launched by Ajahn Chah in the early days of Wat Pa Phong, the no prisoners taken approach to Dhamma. There's so much of it is cast in the terms of building paramita, learning to be patient, learning to be honest, learning to be intelligent, learning to arouse energy. It's just knowing what to develop, learning how to develop it, putting forth the energy to develop it, just cranking up moment by moment, minute by minute, day by day, week by week, month by month. The capacity whereby those simple everyday insights that no experience can be totally permanently satisfying, no thing in the universe, mental or physical, can be in a state of total stability, predictability. There is no owner for any kind of object or experience. These simple, easily understood concepts, anicca, dukkha, anatta, Four Noble Truths, suffering, origin, cessation, path. It's through the building of paramita, building those spiritual virtues, that we clear the clouds in the system. We sensitize the system whereby those genuine insights, the liberating insights, can really be actualized. But even if we feel we haven't got that much paramita, or we haven't got sufficient spiritual virtue, we can still just actively contemplating the Four Noble Truths, just cultivating an interest, an exploratory attitude to them, can help us enormously. So it's not manufacturing an insight, but just gathering the ingredients whereby those insights can be catalyzed, they can be nurtured, they can be brought into being. Seeing, reminding ourselves over and over that this is the key learning process above everything else that we're here to do. It's this penetration of the Four Noble Truths and understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Just reminding ourselves, this is the key thing. Just seeing the chemistry of how we feel alienated, lost, restless, oppressed, irritated, incomplete, unsatisfied. Just that's what we're here to learn. The engine of that discontent. How does that engine work? What drives it? What's its fuel? How can it be so convincing, so compelling, so all-pervasive? So we just make ourselves, bring ourselves to the task of exploring that, investigating that, getting interested in that. What is this? How does this work? So essentially in this, it's to do with desire, isn't it? Craving. The mechanism of craving. This is the cause of dukkha. So in a way, it begins, the whole thing begins at truth number two, the cause, and then the effect of that cause is truth number one, the presence of that feeling of discontent, incompleteness, unsatisfactoriness, alienation, stress, dis-ease. imbalance, out of orderedness. However we want to translate that all-encompassing word dukkha, that feeling of the universe being out of balance, out of order, not quite rightness, or very not rightness. But it begins, the cause of that is in a way where it starts. Tanha, craving or thirst. That's the root, that's the infection, that's the cause of the spiritual malaise. That's the bug. It's tanha, craving. So then it behooves us to get interested in that. Well, how is that? How does that work? What is that feeling? Where does it come from? What drives it? What shape does it have? How do I feel that? So much of our practice in our life is just aimed at bringing the lens of investigation to that quality of tanha. Getting to know its different qualities, its different dimensions, and how convincing it is. Another of the teachings that both Lumpur Sumedho, Lumpur Cha would give, you know, over and over again, and over the ages, you know, ever since, you know, things began in the Dhamma teaching, this has been a point that's been emphasized, is, you know, that desire is a liar. Craving is a liar. You know, when the mind moves into the feeling of tanha, the attention gets locked onto an object, whether it's a subtle object, like in the realms of bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, the desire to become, the desire to get rid of, nebulous feelings of pointlessness or negativity or nihilism, just the subtle wishes to get rid of irritating thoughts or impatience with a pain in the body, desire to get rid of, or the subtle feelings of becoming, the desire to become bhava tanha, trying to become more peaceful, trying to become less confused or corrupted by agitated thoughts or feelings, desire to become a better person, desire to become more wise, more peaceful, more accomplished, reasonable and convincing desires to get rid of, to become. Or if it's something much more rampant and florid, the sense desire, wanting to eat something or smoke something or a desire to latch onto some alluring sexual object, get close to something that's exciting, stimulating, something to smell, something to touch, something to taste, something to hear, see, something to carry the senses away, you know, to absorb into shocking, frightening, interesting, alluring, filling the mind. You know, But in all these different cases, whether it's the most subtle murmurings of identification with formless jhana, to just insatiable cravings for a hit of some drug of choice, alcohol or tobacco, or some obsession of sight or sound or feeling. Contact, from the most subtle to the coarse, in every situation. And this is the interesting thing, the fascinating thing, is that, and having been looking at this for many years, of watching this for many years, is that every time the desire lies, because what it always says is, if I just had this, if I could just get rid of that, if I could just hang on to this, if I could just shift away from that, then I would be happy. then I would be complete. If I could just get hold of this thing to provide the missing piece, if I could just get away from this painful feeling, if I could just activate this potential, if I could just get close to that object, if I could just devour that fruit, that cake, that person, if I could just become a success, if I could just get approval, if I could just get away from this ailment, if I could just, then I would be happy, I'd be complete, I'd be fulfilled, I'd be satisfied. And oftentimes, mostly 99 times out of 100, the thinking mind doesn't spell it out. And because even if we took the trouble to spell it out, then it spoils the illusion, it kind of ruins the trick. And it's mostly wordless, it's mostly unconceptual, the way that craving works, tanha works most effectively in the non-verbal realm. But we see over and over again, I want, I gotta have, I need to be, I need to get, I have to get away from, I don't need, I don't want this. How can I get away from this? That's the equation that we're drawing, isn't it? If only this wasn't here, then I'd be happy. If only I had some of that, I'd be happy. If only I was somebody else, then I would be fine. I was just different. If only I wasn't me. I was just somebody else, anybody else. I know I'd be happy. It's a lie. It has to be a lie. It can't hold true, but that's the lie that the heart believes in every time. It's treacherous. Tanha is treacherous. That's why it causes suffering, because it doesn't match reality. It's presenting a Dhamma that doesn't exist. Therefore, we have to be disappointed and frustrated and ultimately let down by the objects of craving that are acquired. Whether it's an object that we're trying to get rid of, or opposing, or we're trying to get hold of, it has to disappoint. It can't do anything else, because things change. Things are insubstantial. They can't satisfy. Sabbe sankhara dukkha, all conditioned phenomena are unsatisfactory. Period. That's it. That's the law of nature. That the heart is missing at that point, because it's saying, this is satisfactory. If I could just have this, if I could just take hold of this, if I could just acquire this object, if I could just be with this person, if I could just get away from that heat, if I could just get close to the heat, I'd be happy. It's a liar. So much of our practice then is just remembering that. And we're feeling the burning of craving. As the Buddha describes so aptly in the fire sermon, sabang bhikkhave aditang, all is burning, because everything is burning. Burning with the fire of raga, dosa, moha, of passion, of aversion, of delusion. So the first step is really just knowing that this is a feeling of desire. The attention out of habit always goes to the object, doesn't it? It goes to the story that's being told about the thing that's irritating, the thing that's painful, this illness that's in the way, or this person who's annoying me, or the practice, the meditation that isn't quite right, or the community that isn't quite doing what I wish it would, or the partner that I'm hooked up with, or the partner I want to be hooked up with, the weather, the food, the mind, the body, the personality. The interest, the attention of the mind latches onto the content, and it pursues that. That's just what it's designed to do. We take hold of the story, and we race after the story. We miss the process because of absorption in the content. So that the first step is, and as it has in the Buddha's own description of the Four Noble Truths, that the first step is recognizing this is dukkha. This is a feeling of incompleteness or discontent. Here it is, it feels like this. And then listening to the voice of the desire and seeing that there is dukkha, then recognizing, well, this dukkha is caused by what? Where is this coming from? It's coming from craving. It's coming from desire. Tanha is burning. So there's some attachment, there's some clinging going on. So what's being clung to? There's the clinging to wanting to get away from this knee pain, wanting to go to the bathroom, wanting to be more enlightened, wanting to be more peaceful, wanting to get out of this community, wanting to get into this community, wanting to be older, wanting to be younger, wanting to be the center of attention, wanting to get out of the center of attention, out of being the center of attention, wanting to any one of 10,000 things. So it's a question of recognizing what's being clung to. Where's the clinging? Is it to a aspect of the past or the future? Is it to a material object? Is it to a relationship? Is it to a thought, a feeling, a mood? Where is it? And sure enough, every time we look, then you see if there's dukkha, it's because there's some clinging going on. So then we look, explore, see where the clinging is happening. And then one of the things that's most important is rather than trying to, as soon as we see that we're attached to some idea about the past or the future, about a way we want to be seen, a way that we're afraid of being seen, or wanting to get hold of a material object or get rid of a material object. As soon as we recognize where the mind is clinging, we immediately want to do something about that. We want to get rid of that and get away from it or destroy it or fix it. But one of the most useful aspects of the practice and is most effective in following things through is just to notice that feeling of craving for what it is. Just let yourself take the attention off the object, off the content, and feel the process of craving. Just let yourself really know what it's like to crave. So whether it's craving a cigarette, or craving for approval, or craving to travel, or craving to stay, or craving to be different, doesn't matter. Just bringing the attention into the body, into the feeling mind, saying, this is the feeling of craving. This is the heart really wanting. This is the gotta have, can't stand feeling. Here it is. So it takes a bit of effort to do. It takes an incredible effort to extract the attention from the content and just look at that feeling of craving, whether it's subtle, just a kind of gentle murmur, or whether it's an outright dragon roar. Just to know it. This is the experience of craving. And then when we do that, then we can listen more clearly to the voice of craving, what's craving for. We can develop more of an objectivity for the content. Be listening to the heart, grumbling and complaining, trying to get away from, get rid of, dispel something that's negative, or opinionating about something neutral, or longing for something desirable, attractive and appealing. We learn to listen to those voices. And that when we listen, then we can begin to recognize the lying, the deceitful quality. Because when we listen and we actually hear the voices of the heart saying, if I just had such and such, then I'd be happy. If I could just get away from this place, then I'd be happy. If I could just get to stay here all the time, then I'd be happy. If I just was, if I had a different personality, then I'd be happy. If I was just more of this, less of that. If I could just get this. If I could just finish this project. If I could just get this thing. If I could just get rid of this thing, then I would be happy. And when those voices are heard, when we listen to the content of the craving, when we hear it spelled out clearly and consciously, it's much more easy to recognize the lie. So the first thing is to recognize the feeling of craving and just recognize how incredibly uncomfortable that is. It's just a really nasty feeling. It's a really unpleasant, oppressive feeling. And it's not kind of deadly, but just the discomfort of the mind being in that state. And we're not opinionating about that or blaming it, just letting ourselves know that, gee, this is really a really unpleasant state of body and mind. Why would I want to move towards situations where this state is multiplied and increased? Why would I want to do anything that would aggravate or amplify this feeling of craving? And, you know, we realize that in doing that, we're kind of going counter to the culture and to the human conditioning, where rousing desire, craving and agitation is a large part of life. Trying to get excited, get interested, get active, get moving, keep the whole thing spinning. Incredible amounts of disposable income and human energy is spent cranking it up, keeping it going, and looking upon the absence of that as the living death. But if we lay aside those cultural assumptions and that conditioning, and we actually just look at the feeling of the heart in the state of craving, longing to get hold of, longing to get rid of, longing to have sense pleasure, just feeling it without any kind of frills whatsoever, just, gee, this is really painful. Like, why would I seek out having a toothache, you know? Why would I do something to really make, you know, to make my life pressured and miserable? It would be crazy. So not from a judgmental or idealistic position, but just from raw common sense. You think, gee, why would I want to do this to myself? Ugh. And then it's that much easier to drop it. And then when we listen to the stories that it's telling in a clear and unbiased way, and similarly, then again, the heart will say, well, that's not very convincing, or, okay, you know, that's something that's sweet, it's a sweet taste and that's appealing, or it's a bitter taste and that's off-putting. But no way is that going to make me totally happy forever. And the heart knows that. The intuition, the intuitive wisdom is right there. We know that. The heart knows that. But it's only when it's distracted by the confusions of habit that we don't realize that. Yeah, we're kind of swept along by it. But when we get familiar with it, we see how it works, we realize it's a liar. And, you know, desire objects are totally transferable. You know, it's totally shameless sometimes. You know, it just kind of, the mind's going berserk wanting to get something for hours and hours and hours. And then when finally it can't get that, then it's like, okay, well, I'll have one of those instead. Like, there's a story I once heard Peter Cook of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore once telling, when way back in the late 50s, I think, maybe early 60s, when they were at Cambridge University and they were part of the Cambridge Footlights kind of undergrad comedy club. Cambridge Footlights Review is a sort of stand-up comic organization. That's kind of the place that Monty Python crew came out of as well. Anyway, back in the early 60s, I guess it was about maybe 1960, 61, when Peter Cook was running this, he had the brilliant idea of inviting Lenny Bruce to come over from New York. Mm. Yeah, suitably shocking and outrageous, enough to ruffle the sensibilities of even the most liberal of Brits, and so they thought, let's get Lenny Bruce over, and he can do a session for the Footlights Review. And so they went to great expense, rattled their all their piggy banks, and gathered together their funds, and got Lenny Bruce to fly over from New York to England for this session in Cambridge. And so this is a big event, and this kind of famous and outrageous American comedian coming over. And then Peter Cook is this sort of tall, gangly, nervous Englishman, and goes to pick up Lenny Bruce at the airport, and is sort of organizing his things and carrying his bags and getting him sorted into a taxi to get from the airport. And he says, and welcoming him and introducing himself and helping him to get settled. And he says, "Is there anything that we can do for you? Anything that you might need, or anything that we can provide for you while you're here?" And Lenny Bruce said, "Well, you got any heroin?" Is heroin? What? He says, "Oh yeah, some kind of a drug, isn't it?" Mm-hmm. Not really. I'm sure we could get some for you if you really need it." He says, Yeah, I kind of really need it, so that'd be great." So then Peter Cook, feeling somewhat out of his depth, gets Lenny Bruce back to Cambridge and gets him settled, and then he gets on the phone to his friend Dudley Moore, because Dudley, he said, where is he going to find any heroin in Cambridge? I mean, he knew where the good pubs were, but this was 1961, they hadn't even heard of marijuana in those days. And so he thought, well, Dud, he's a musician. He kind of, they're all drug takers, aren't they? Part of the fact that Dudley Moore was a sort of classical musician and had been doing a scholarship at Oxford in classical piano was kind of escaped his notice. But he thought, well, Dud, he's a musician, he'll know. So then he called up little Dud and said, Dud, we got Lenny Bruce over for the Footlights Review, and he's from New York, and he wants some heroin. Do you know any of your musicians and friends who are kind of heroin users?" And he says, "What's heroin?" Isn't that the kind of the woman in the movie who kind of does all the heroic acts? Isn't she that? He said, "No, you fool! It's a kind of drug. It comes from opium." He said, "Oh, really? Well, drugs. Got some junior aspirin." And anyway, they flustered around and they tried to call up various friends, and all to no avail. And so then they went round to the hotel in Cambridge, and it was already late at night by this time, and went to see Lenny in his hotel room. He says, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Bruce, but we've tried ever so hard, and we've searched around, but this is really not something that we're very well acquainted with, and we didn't really know sort of who to talk to or where to go, and it is kind of sort of illegal." if it's really that important, I'm sure that things will be getting very, very sort of uncomfortable for you if you're going to suffer from withdrawal symptoms and all those kind of things that we've heard about. So we can really keep trying if need be." He says, "Don't worry about it. How about some chocolate cake instead?" So, and he was totally happy with a piece of chocolate cake. So. So sometimes it's like that, isn't it? That you're trying ever so hard to come up with one particular desire object, and yet if A, object A is totally unavailable, then okay, no heroin, never mind. Chocolate cake will do. Not that I'm advocating heroin usage or even chocolate cake usage in the evenings at Bayagiri, but that's the way it is. The mind is totally fickle. Desire objects, if the door to object A is totally shut and is unavailable, okay, well, just switch the program and go to object B. I also have vivid memories of, I mentioned many times of an occasion when I was on retreat in the forest at Chithurst many years ago, a 3-month solitary retreat there, and One day I was I would just take a little sitting mat and sit in different parts of the forest on different days, and I remember parking myself down by the lake one day and sitting in this particular spot, and I sat there for like 4 or 5 hours, and the whole time the mind was just from almost the moment where I sat down, it was rabidly pursuing all kinds of sexual desires, just one kind of memory after another of every kind of erotic encounter of my not incredibly long life. Mm-hmm. I guess I was, what would I have been then, about 10 vasas, I think, so maybe 31, 32 years old. And I've been a monk, you know, I've been in the monastery since I was 21. But anyway, it was just every encounter imaginable, memorable, was being replayed in glorious technicolor, one after another, and then sort of taking an encounter and then sort of racing off where it might have gone and what might have happened if only she'd been like this or I hadn't been like that, or the gun, and then if he hadn't shown up, or if I had more of this and less of that. And so I sat there for all this time, like 4 or 5 hours, just saying no, 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 no. No, no, no. It was almost comical after a time. It was just like this whole sort of, it was like going through the card index, looking for a library, looking through a library book. Just one card after another, after another, after another. And you know, each one very sort of dramatic and colorful and pungent. And just, you know, doing my best to not follow those. But it was just this relentless succession of desires. Just this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. And finally, after this many hours of this, suddenly they reached a point of... and it was just got so normal. It was just like sitting there for 4 hours, 5 hours or something, just listening to this, going on and on and on and on. And suddenly it was almost like, okay, well that one's not working. Let's try this instead. And the all sense of craving and sense desire for alluring objects just switched off. This was like a light being shut down, and then it changed to aversion immediately. Just all of this, just nothing but for 4 or 5 hours, but just one alluring object after another. And then you could almost hear the voice saying, well, that one's not working, okay, let's try dosa instead. And then the mind immediately started coming up with thinking of irritating things about the people I live with and what was wrong with all the other monks. And it was just so blatant. It was like, so absurd. It was like nothing but one sort of craving for sense pleasure after another for 4 or 5 hours, and suddenly, boom, gone completely. No interest in that. And now it's all these, what's wrong with all the people that I live with? And so it was actually comical. Like I think, well, wait a minute. What's going on here? For the last 4 or 5 hours, there's been this trying to convince the mind to chase after all these alluring things that I really got to have, and my life is incomplete if I don't, getting back in touch with so and so, or this one or that one or the other one. And then suddenly they're all gone. The whole entire guest list of characters in the memories of sexual encounters of one kind, real or imagined, suddenly, boom, all gone. And then, and he's like this, and he shouldn't do that, and she's this way, and that's all wrong, shouldn't be this way. It was absurd. It was kind of farcical. I almost started, I actually did start chuckling to myself. It's like, that it was so ridiculous. It was so obvious, just fire seeking some fuel. And just like a forest fire, it doesn't have a mind, it doesn't have a consciousness, but it seems like it does, because it seeks whatever is burnable. It goes, it'll take whatever fuel is in its path, and it'll pursue any path where there's combustible fuel. in exactly the same way. It was just the burning mind, the craving mind, just looking for something burnable. And there was nothing. Wasn't getting much to ignite in the desire, in the desire part, in the loba, the greed section. It was all a bit soggy and and non-flammable. So it's okay. Let's try the dosa department. Let's go to aversion and negativity and see if there's something that's going to ignite over there. It was a really good lesson to me. It was just. Because the contrast was so extreme, and yet, for the whole first few hours, it had been just doing its level best to try and get the mind to buy into. This is so interesting. This is so attractive. So beautiful. So great. Wow. So amazing. And so, and that the value system, that you know, the lie being presented over and over and over, with you know all kinds of different. You know, evidence and value and imagination and thought and memory to back it up. But it was just a lie that it's telling you you're incomplete unless you get close to this, unless you have this. And it was, and then that sudden switch from the one object to another, like the heroin to the chocolate cake, it's a lie. It's saying that you've got to have this to be happy. No, it's a lie. It just, any object will do, any old fuel will do. It's just trying to get a bite, trying to get a nibble, trying to get a, oh yeah, right. I do need to get some of that. I have got to get away from this. I can't stand that. He shouldn't do that. That is wrong. And then you can almost hear the hook going in, like, got him. And like Lumpur Chah would say, it's not even like a fish swallowing a hook, getting it through its cheek. It's like a frog, which takes it right down into the stomach. It swallows the hook right down. Down it goes. Got him. That's the hook. The hook is in. We've got a bite. So it's the challenge then is to remember. It's a lie. It's a lie. It's just, if we put our interest onto some particular desire system and buy into it and believe in it and inflate it, it becomes true. That is something that's valuable and good and wonderful. We have got to have it. That is something that's bad and wrong and it shouldn't be that way. And we have got to get rid of it. And it becomes so because we create it. So we believe in it. We buy it. We've swallowed the hook. Therefore, we're born into it, and we go along with it. And then the craving turns to clinging, the clinging turns to becoming, and the becoming turns to birth. We're born into getting rid of that thing, opinionating about that thing, getting away from that thing, getting hold of that thing. And in the moment of becoming, we thought, yeah, we're vindicated. Yeah, this is good. This is great. I can't stand it. I got to get away from this guy. It is wrong. And the moment of becoming is that moment of conviction, of vindication, of fulfillment. Like we were talking about anger and the feeling of the Buddha's description of anger that is you know, pleasing in the short term and then. Regrettable in the long term. There's a great pleasure involved in expressing anger. It feels great to really let somebody have it when you're righteously indignant or unrighteously indignant. But then, after the becoming, birth, and then after birth, and there's no turning back, then we get the bill. Then we have the tense relationship. Then we have the fear of people finding out of the thing that you've stolen, or you have to defend the opinion that you've been espousing, or the relationship gets boring. Soka parideva dukkha dominasa upayasa. Yeah, along with the birth, then inevitably there comes the the karmic result of that. You know, the thrill fades away, the excitement of getting angry or getting away from that pain, then another pain comes back. Oh no, now it's my left knee. Yeah, this is not a kind of diatribe against the human world, the living world, but this is just how experience works. If we buy into a sankhara, a formation, and believe it to be something real and solid and permanent, and try to make it so, we have to be disappointed. When you try to seek satisfaction in that which cannot satisfy, we have to be disappointed. It can't be any other way. And that's not a sour point of view, it's just physics. It's just the mathematics of experience. It's just that it can't be any other way. It's totally impersonal. So when we think about the Four Noble Truths, it can seem like a very bland or abstract or impersonal quality or impersonal sort of framework. But when we really look at what they're pointing to, this is a very nub of our existence, the very kind of essence of our feeling of being in the world is described by this. And then importantly, the dukkha nirodha, the cessation of dukkha, because the way that the source of the origin of dukkha is handled, or is the appropriate relationship to it, is pahata banti. It is to be relinquished. That craving is to be relinquished. And then, as the Buddha recognized, pahinanti, it has been relinquished, has been let go of. And when we let go of that craving, when we recognize, oh, this is a feeling of craving, this is the heart really wanting to get hold of this, wanting to get rid of that, got to be somewhere else, got to get something else, got to have this. This is craving. This is the liar. This is the lie. And then seeing it's a lie, choosing not to follow it, choosing not to go along with it, releasing the heart from that. Then there's dukkha nirodha. And that's the good news. This is the beauty of the Dhamma, is right here. When the heart lets go of trying to make a sankhara into asankhara, asankata, making the formed into the unformed, trying to get the born to be the unborn, the time-bound to be the timeless. We stop trying to do that, then the heart opens to the timeless, to the unborn, to the Dhamma itself. The reality of the fundamental wholeness, orderliness, completeness of the Dhamma. It's always here. Nothing is missing. Nothing is extra. There's nothing we have to get rid of, nothing we have to find to make ourselves complete. The Dhamma is complete. It's always here. It's never anywhere else. It's never lacking anything. Never burdened with anything. Nothing we have to get rid of, nothing we have to acquire for the Dhamma to be completed. It's always perfect, whole. So that realization, dukkha nirodha, is the freeing the heart from stress, freeing the heart from alienation, from that feeling of wrongness. That's the purpose, the goal of all of our efforts, that is to allow the heart to awaken to that perfection of the Dhamma, to realize its own nature. And the Eightfold Path, the three trainings of Sila, Samadhi, Panya, these are all the ways that we cultivate that same transition from the second truth to the third truth. It's the way that that bridge is crossed from how we let go of, recognize craving and let go of it. It's through Sila, Samadhi, Panya. That's how the bridge from truth number two to truth number three is crossed. How that transition, transformation is brought about. What more worthy thing is there to do with our lives? What else is there to do? What else is there to do? Where can you go where this won't pertain? What can you fill your mind with? And what activity can you put your attention on that's going to make this not true? It's going to provide some sort of alternative reality that can hold together. Yeah, I don't think there's any such animal myself. It's nothing that geography can supply, or a different social group can supply, or a, yeah. It's always this is the ordering of the universe, mental and physical. This is how it works. So that the people that you're with, or the country that you're in, or even the system of thinking and language around you, it doesn't make any difference. The Four Noble Truths pertain. That's the very description of the spiritual illness and its cure. It's this way everywhere. It's an all-encompassing, non-sectarian, nationalism-free patterning of the universe. This is how it works, and it's just amazing how incredible the Buddha boiled down all the vast range of things that he understood. He crystallized it into this one extraordinarily simple and clear, insightful expression. It just so soon after the enlightenment, he boiled it down to this, defined it as this, and how. You know, all these years later, that still is such a perfect and precious instrument to examine our lives with, and to guide them towards the fulfillment as possible. Anyone?
Hello, my Namakataya Sadhu Karangadama Se Sadhu.